A warning, this episode contains descriptions of graphic violence and sexual molestation. Please listen with discretion. We are all familiar with the constitutional right of defendants to plead the Fifth, a principle that no one can be forced to testify against their own self-interest and incriminate themselves in a legal proceeding. This, however, is just a right. A defendant in this country can waive that right and incriminate themselves under oath all they like, and that testimony will be admissible in a court of law. Did you know, though, that thousands of years ago, the law against self-incrimination was established in ancient Jewish courts, but in a distinctly different way? It wasn't considered a right that a defendant could exercise or waive. Rather, self-incriminatory statements were not admissible at all as evidence, under any circumstance. This rule was originally derived from the principle that no man is competent to testify in his own favor, and therefore the converse should also hold true, that no man can call himself a wrongdoer. But there were other reasons for the rule against admitting statements of self-incrimination. First, because courts deemed anyone who would incriminate themselves as inherently untrustworthy, and thereby unable to be a competent witness. Some feared that people would deliberately incriminate themselves so the courts would find they weren't credible and then disqualify them as witnesses. Then there was the theory proposed by Maimonides, Rambam himself, the greatest Jewish philosopher and rabbi of the medieval period, who believed that this rule existed to prevent, quote, melancholy and depressed persons from confessing to crimes which they have not committed and end up being put to death, which would be an unthinkable tragedy. It was surprising to me to learn that over 1,000 years ago, the sages in their vast wisdom were already concerned about false confessions, because I thought this was a phenomenon that has only recently been discovered and understood in the modern era. Honestly, if you'd asked me as recently as a decade ago whether I'd ever confess to a crime I didn't commit, I would have responded with a resounding, of course not. The flip side of that being, I thought if someone did confess to a crime, then of course that means they must have done it. And I'm pretty sure most of us thought the same way, until just a few years ago. Certainly, the investigators in the Sharon Johnson murder thought so, back in the late 1980s. Now, we know it's not just depressed and melancholy people who will falsely confess. It might be fair to say that almost anyone, including myself, is vulnerable to confessing to a crime they didn't commit, given the right circumstances. But experts have narrowed down the factors that contribute to false confessions, so that when they review a confession, they can identify the red flags. And in this case, the confessions are littered with them. Welcome to Undisclosed. My name is Rabia Jadi. I'm an attorney and author of the New York Times bestseller, Adnan Story. And I'm here with my colleagues, Susan Simpson and Colin Miller.
Hi, this is Susan Simpson. I'm an attorney in Washington, D.C., and I blog at The View from LL2.
Hi, this is Colin Miller. I'm an associate dean and professor at the University of South Carolina School of Law, and I blog at Evidence Prof Blog.
My name is Haley Cleary. I'm an associate professor of criminal justice and public policy at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond, Virginia. I am, by training, a developmental psychologist, so I specialize in adolescent development in legal contexts.
We reached out to Haley Cleary because she's one of the top experts in studying the phenomenon of false confessions, and also because she's testified in such cases, particularly those involving young people.
So with youth in particular, there are principles of psychosocial development, like their vulnerability to influence from others, especially authority figures. Youth brains are not primed for good decision-making in stressful contexts, right? The parts of the brain that govern judgment and future orientation and planning and contingency planning, literally those parts of the brain are not fully developed and integrated with other brain circuitry systems until really the mid-20s on average. And so all of those things are really relevant to decision-making, and they create some vulnerabilities for kids who are focused on getting out of this stressful situation right here and now, even at the expense of serious consequences down the road.
According to Cleary, being young itself is a contributing factor to being vulnerable to buckling under pressure and falsely confessing. And so we can check that factor off for both Tony and Jason, who are both teenagers at the time they gave their confessions. But there are plenty of additional factors to consider.
So when you, as an expert, are evaluating confessions, what are you looking for? What kind of red flags are you seeking?
Sure. So we look for long interrogations are a red flag. Interrogation tactics that are psychologically manipulative, either in an anxiety-producing way, sort of emphasizing the seriousness of the offense or the potential consequences, or conversely, minimizing the offense seriousness or creating a situation in which it feels easier to confess. I look at kids, their age, their intellectual abilities, the circumstances in which they were interrogated. So did they have a support person? Was it in the middle of the night? Did they go long stretches without sleep or food? Those are all, like you say, red flags. It does not mean that the presence of one of those factors necessarily indicates a false confession, but they are definitely things that we look for because in the research, they are associated with both involuntary and unreliable confessions.
Okay, so as we examine Jason and Tony's confessions, we need to think about how long they were interrogated for, any factors that made it easier for them to confess, such as promises or minimizations, manipulative tactics that induce anxiety, and the role of any support persons. But what about the substantive content of the confession itself? Any red flags to be found there?
If we're lucky enough to have an actual recording of the interrogation or a transcript of the interrogation, we look at the content, especially for what's called contamination. So contamination happens when details about the crime that are supposed to be known only to police and the true perpetrator are fed to the suspect, either intentionally or inadvertently, that then become incorporated into the suspect's confession narrative. And so we look for who first introduced these ideas that it was, you know, three shots fired and not five. Who first introduced the idea that the person was found in the woods and not in a dumpster? You know, those kinds of details that only the perpetrator should know, they look really, really convincing to outsiders, right? Because it's a colorful narrative of exactly how the crime occurred and maybe even why it occurred. But if those details came from police first, then we can't be certain that the suspect generated that from previous knowledge. That's what we call confession contamination.
That's not all, though.
We look for things like, and this is especially relevant with youth, negative feedback or things like yield and shift in their interrogation statement. So in other words, indicators that the suspect might be saying what they think the investigator wants to hear and responding to, again, kind of unspoken but implied suggestions that what you said previously wasn't what they were looking for. So
your statement changes over time is what you're saying.
Yeah, and it sometimes is quite subtle, but it can be in response to interrogative pressures and not because the person is actually guilty.
Informational contamination, negative feedback, yield and shift. Again, all things we need to keep in mind as we go through the confessions in this case. And then finally, there's this.
Can you talk a little bit about what effect might have on a young person if a family member is present during the interrogation?
So that's a good question. It's a complicated question, and it could have a number of different effects. And so family members can be sources of support and relief. They could also be antagonists. If the family member is sort of recruited by police, we see this with parents, unfortunately, quite often, where police and parents kind of team up against the kid to try to get information. It's problematic because there are a number of states that require parents' consent to interrogate youth, or sometimes even their involvement in the interrogation. And those laws are based on the premise that parents can serve as protectors for teenagers in that environment. But we see from actual interrogation research that that's not always the case.
We're going to add one more red flag to look for as we go through these confessions, and that's this. Keeping an eye out for information that is plainly wrong. If a confession includes facts that are easily disprovable or that themselves contradict what we know about the crime, it's fair to say that's a big red flag. So now that we know what to look for, let's dive in.
We'll go through the confessions chronologically. And the first confession that's made on the record is the March 1st, 1989 confession that Tony gave about moving the car. It might not seem like a confession because Tony didn't involve himself in any aspect of the murder, but he still confessed to having an inadvertent part in the crime. Either way, the statement is incredibly important in that, if true, it unequivocally points to Ken as being the culprit. Now remember, Tony gave this information to Sergeant Roland Lammy over the phone, all the way from North Carolina. You could argue that while Tony was a youth, none of the situational factors that otherwise might have pressured him into falsely confessing existed. He wasn't being interrogated in person, and the likelihood of being intimidated over the phone by an investigator was low. On the other hand, we don't have an exact transcript of that conversation, which is a bit odd because we have transcripts of so many other phone calls in the case. Instead, we have a summary report written by Sergeant Lammy. Reports like this have to be taken with a grain of salt because there's no way of knowing what's been left out. In this case, we don't even know how long that phone call lasted. Here's what Tony says. That around the time of the murder, he was living with a woman named Karen and her husband. This part checks out. Tony was in fact living with a woman named Karen Polin for roughly the last 2 weeks of July, a fact that the police corroborated by interviewing Karen twice. Next, Tony says that around 5:30 p.m. on Friday, July 29th, he got a call from Ken Johnson. He later corrected himself to say that he himself called Ken, looking for Lisa, which is more likely to be true for a couple of reasons. First, he really was looking for Lisa, and we'll get to that in a moment, but also because Tony didn't have his own phone number. Rather, he bounced around so much that he was barely in the same place for more than 2 or 3 weeks. Unless Ken was keeping track of where Tony was at all times, he wouldn't have had any way of knowing where to call Tony in the first place, or even when to call him. If this conversation between Ken and Tony actually happened, it rings true that Tony would have been the one to make the call. You're probably wondering about Ken's phone records. Did they show any calls coming in? Well, it turns out the records don't show incoming phone calls. Only calls that were made out, and those that would toll. In other words, the calls that wouldn't be included in local charges. And there's no record at all of any calls made from the Johnson house to Manchester, where Tony was living. Now, Tony says that he called Ken around 5:30 p.m. We know Ken was home then because the police had come by around 4:45 to inform the family that the body they'd found in Bedford that morning had been positively identified as Sharon. No one else knew this at the time, though. The news didn't report the identification until the early edition of the papers the next morning. If Tony had called the house, he definitely wouldn't have been able to reach Ken then, who was on and off the phone all day. Remember that phone conversation one of the officers overheard in which Ken told someone that police had found Sharon's body naked? That brings us to the question of where Tony was. Was it possible for him to have been home at Karen Pullen's apartment and to have made the call to Ken? Turns out it was.
Tony's work records show that he'd begun a pretty long shift of cleaning commercial kitchens starting from the night before. And on the day he says he called Ken, he had wrapped up work around 3:30 p.m. in Holden, Massachusetts, which was over an hour away from where he lived. He would have gotten home close to 5 p.m., so yes, he could have made the call to Ken's house at around 5:30. Next, Tony says that Ken told him his wife's car was parked in front of Don's Sports Center, where the canoes are, and asked him to move it to the Sears parking lot and leave the keys under the seat. Tony says he went to the movie theater close to the mall around 8 p.m., walked to Don's store, found Sharon's car, as Ken had said, moved it to the Sears parking lot, and left the keys under the seat, then walked to the theater to join his friends. To refresh your memory, the Sears parking lot was checked numerous times that day, first by Sharon's brother, then by a number of patrol officers. Sharon's brother checked the lot in the afternoon, but there's no record of what time the officers patrolled the area. What we do know is that none of them saw the car there at the time they checked, but that evening, around 9 p.m., the employee in charge of moving cars from the lot into the Sears garage saw one lone car sitting by itself in the lot. Tony has no way of knowing any of this. Not that Sharon's car wasn't in the Sears lot earlier, or that it may have been seen by that employee after 9 p.m. And yet, his timeline for allegedly moving the car fits the known facts perfectly. That would only be possible if all of this really did happen, or if the police fed up information that he'd spun into the story, or if those things were reported in the media and Tony had learned about them that way. Our research assistant, Jennifer Leahy, scoured all of the print media that was published about the murder and didn't find a single instance of it having been reported that the car had been moved to the Sears lot after the lot had been initially checked. So we can eliminate the possibility that Tony learned about any of these facts from the media then. So could Sergeant Lammy have fed Tony this information? It's possible that he did, and it simply isn't recorded in his report. But could Tony have been pressured to make it all up over the phone, knowing well that he would get sucked into the murder case?
In two follow-up calls with Tony on March 6th and 8th, Tony again confirmed to Sergeant Lammy that everything he said was true. And he even said the police could check with his friend, Doug Roberts, who was with him when he had made that call to Ken. Tony said not only was Doug Roberts with him that evening, but that Doug also accompanied him to see Ken the following morning on Saturday, July 30th, to get Lisa's number. Tony said that as he got out of the car, Ken came out onto the porch and handed him a piece of paper with Lisa's phone number and address on it. He said Ken wasn't friendly and just went back inside. By the way, this meeting on the porch becomes an important part of the state's case against Jason Carroll, even though Jason's name hasn't come up at all yet. No one has mentioned him, but just keep this porch incident in mind and we'll circle back to it. Now, according to Tony, Doug accompanied him to Rhode Island to see Lisa the very next day, on Sunday, and it didn't go well. Tony told Sergeant Lammy that Lisa attacked him when he showed up to see her. All of these are pretty specific details, and it's quite possible they all could have taken place in terms of Tony's schedule, because Tony was free after 5 p.m. on Friday, and he didn't work on Saturday or Sunday either. The problem was, Doug Roberts said none of it happened. You might remember that Doug Roberts was the guy who, when he was interviewed, told the police that he'd stopped hanging out with Tony by June, because Tony had been stealing from him. There was no way he was with Tony in late July around the time of the murder. They had stopped being friends by then. So then why did Tony bring up Doug numerous times, telling the police to check the veracity of his statements by talking to Doug? The thing is that Tony might still have been telling the truth, but have been confused about who he was with that weekend. Right before he moved in with Karen Poulin and her husband in mid-July of 1988, Tony lived with a young man named Donald Roy. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it's because this is the same person from last episode who told Paul Devereaux, the guy that Jason had lunch with every day, his best friend, that the police wanted to talk to Jason Carroll. Remember, Paul had then passed the message on to Jason. You might be wondering how all these guys knew each other and what their relationship was. Jason Carroll and Tony Puff came from fairly different social circles, but they'd both begun working at the high-tech fire prevention company in July of 1988. As far as we can tell, that's when they first got to know each other and became friendly, hanging out on Elm Street in Manchester with a group of teenagers, which included Paul Devereaux and Donald Roy. While Jason and Tony did socialize outside of work, according to Paul Devereaux's testimony at trial, they weren't really friends. But we'll get more into the relationship a bit later. For now, back to Donald Roy. When Donald Roy was interviewed by the police, which wasn't for 6 months after Tony's statement, he remembered things that lined up with some of the details that Tony gave about that weekend. Roy was interviewed by Sergeant Lammy at the end of October in 1989, over a year after the murder. His timeline of events is pretty scattered, and that's understandable, given that over a year had passed. Donald Roy had met Tony in March of 1988 when Tony began working at the same restaurant as Roy. At some point over the summer, Tony had moved in with Roy for a bit, but he had moved out on July 16th. Donald Roy remembered that Tony had been fired from his job at High Tech Prevention around the same time for harassing a girl at work. Tony, however, had been fired in September of that year, months later. So while it's clear that Roy has the timeline of events confused, it's also clear that he was hanging out with Tony at least through the time that Tony was fired, in September, whereas Doug Roberts had stopped being friends with Tony back in June. Donald Roy specifically remembered going with Tony once, just once, to the Johnson house in Bow to meet Lisa. But the report doesn't state when this happened or if they did actually meet Lisa or not. Roy also remembered driving all the way to Rhode Island with Tony in July of 1988 to go and meet Lisa. But he believed it was in early July, not late July, because when they got there, Tony told Lisa that he had been trying to get a hold of her all summer, but that every time he called the Johnson house, Sharon or Ken refused to share her contact information. Roy figured that because of the fact that Tony mentioned Sharon, it must have meant that this happened before Sharon was murdered. Except that's not necessary. First of all, Tony might not have even known yet that Sharon was dead when he went to go see Lisa that weekend. He certainly didn't know it on Friday when he allegedly moved the car, and unless he watched the news or read the newspapers, he wouldn't have known it on Sunday either. Conversely, even if he had learned that Sharon had been murdered, it still could have made sense for him to tell Lisa in the past when he'd call Sharon, Sharon would not share Lisa's contact information. Donald Roy also remembered another detail about that visit. He recalled that Tony and Lisa got into a physical altercation. Specifically, he remembered Tony pulling Lisa's hair and that a neighbor had come to break up the fight. This might have been the same incident Tony was referring to when he told Sergeant Lammy about Lisa attacking him. According to Lisa, Tony only ever made that one trip to Rhode Island that summer to see her. So it seems pretty likely that it was on the weekend that Tony said it happened, right after Sharon was murdered. The trip that Donald Roy remembered making to the Johnson home might also have been the trip that Tony said in his statement he made with Doug Roberts on Saturday morning to get Lisa's contact info. So basically, it's very likely that Tony was confusing Doug Roberts and Donald Roy, that it had not been Doug with him that weekend at all. It had been Donald. Unfortunately, Sergeant Lammy didn't ask Donald Roy any more details that might have corroborated Tony's story, like whether he remembered Tony calling Ken or going with Tony to the movies on that Friday night. If he had, then maybe he would have been able to corroborate Tony's statements and had enough to arrest Ken. He didn't get enough, though, not until a month after he spoke to Donald Roy, when Sergeant Lammy finally interrogated Jason Carroll.
According to Professor Haley Cleary, the red flags we want to look for in terms of the situational factors that could indicate whether or not Jason Carroll's confessions are true or false are the following. The length of the interrogation, the intensity of it, manipulation factors that could induce anxiety, and the role of any family members who were there. Jason's first interrogation took place on Friday, November 24th, and lasted about 5 hours. While that doesn't seem to be a clear-cut case of an unconscionably long interrogation, like one that lasts all night, it's still well past the point of being just an interview. 5 to 6 hours of being interrogated in a tight room with a number of different police officers including one that's 6'4" tall and weighs 260 pounds, is certainly no walk in the park. Talking to anyone for that long would be exhausting. But on the other hand, Jason gave a number of written statements during the duration of that interrogation, the first one written by hand and signed at 3:15 p.m. At that point, he'd only been with the officers for 2 to 3 hours. Jason then gave a second statement at 3:25 p.m., more like an addition to the first one, and then a third statement at 5:25 p.m. It might be hard to make the argument that Jason had been exhausted into falsely confessing, and yet when his mother picked him up that night, she said he was a pale, shaky wreck. We have no transcript or recording of this first interrogation, so we don't know what was said, if any information was fed to Jason, or if the officers intimidated him in any way. What we do know is that he had no family members with him, and of course we have the handwritten statements. The situational factors here are rather hard to assess, to be honest. So next we look at the actual content of those statements. We'll take the first two statements, the ones from 3:15 and 3:25 p.m. together. In the first statement, which is barely two paragraphs long, Jason writes the following. On the night of July 28, 1988, Jason was parked at Meineke Mufflers in Manchester, and Tony pulled up in a green Subaru next to him. When Jason asked him who it belonged to, Tony told him it belonged to a girl who worked at the mall. A tiny note on top of this part says this happened around 8:30 p.m. Jason said that Tony asked him if he would follow him to the mall so he could drop off the car there for the girl who owned it. So Jason followed Tony to the mall. When they got there, Tony messed around in the green car for a bit, left the keys under the seat, grabbed a bag and put it in Jason's truck, and then asked for a ride back to Webster Street in Manchester so he could get picked up for work. After dropping him off, Jason went back to the Meineke Muffler parking lot, but doesn't say why. The 3:25 p.m. addition that was made happened after Jason made a trip to the bathroom and was reminded when he returned about the bag. The report doesn't say what he was reminded of, but we can make a guess given Jason's additional statement, which states that Tony also had asked Jason to drop off the bag, which was a light blue-green color, to Tony's home. Jason states that after he dropped Tony off on Webster Street, he went to Tony's place, knocked on the door, and a woman opened the door, took the bag, and that was it. Then he left. The reminder in this case was probably that Jason needed to deal with the bag. Where did it go? Did it stay in Jason's truck? Did Tony take it with him when he was dropped off in Webster Street? The bag needed some closure.
Jason's final handwritten statement given at 5:25 p.m., which is 4 pages long, is profoundly different than what he had just stated 2 hours earlier. In this statement, Jason says that the day before the murder, on July 27th, Tony asked him to help play a trick on a woman. All Jason had to do was play the role of a man named Bob. Jason said okay, and they agreed to meet at the Meineke Muffler parking lot the next day between 6 and 6:30 p.m., Together, they drove to the mall and got there around 7 p.m. and parked in the Sears parking lot. Jason states that Tony gets out of the car to look for the woman who was sitting in her own parked car, a green Subaru, and that Tony approached her and brought her back to Jason's truck. Jason said she was a pregnant woman with sandy-colored hair and that he introduced himself as Bob. Tony then asked the woman if it was okay that they went to another location so that she could collect the money from Bob, and she agreed. Tony and the woman drove in the Subaru, and Jason followed them in his truck. Tony drove into a wooded area and parked close to a sand pit. Jason parked too, about 75 feet away from them, but stayed behind in his truck and watched as Tony and the woman got out of the car and walked right into the pit, where two men were waiting for them. One of them, said Jason, had a black beard. As Jason watched from his truck, he had music playing and the engine running, but could still hear the voices of the four people in the pit getting louder and louder. He could also see that the bearded man had a knife in his hand, and as the woman had her back to the man, he stabbed her in the back. It looked like the man was going to stab the woman again, and Jason booked it out of there. He drove back to the Meineke parking lot, and shortly thereafter, around 8:30 p.m., Tony drove up in the woman's green Subaru, and the rest of the story went as it did in the earlier statement. Then he followed Tony to the mall, parked the car there, took Tony back to Webster Street, and then dropped off a green-blue bag at Tony's place where a brunette woman in her 40s received it from him. These were the statements that Jason Carroll wanted to recant the next day, but ultimately failed to. There are a couple basic facts here, though, that should leap out at you and should have leaped out at the investigators, which render the story unbelievable. The most obvious is the timing. Jason says they met with Sharon at the mall around 7 p.m., but we know that's not possible at all. Investigators had confirmed that Sharon was buying lottery tickets in Tyngsborough, Massachusetts at 6:57 p.m., which was 25 miles away from the mall. You could argue that maybe Jason's timeline was off by 30 minutes, except that wouldn't explain the numerous mall employees who placed Sharon inside the mall that night, including a woman who specifically remembered waiting on Sharon at around 8 p.m. These witnesses were all interviewed and shown Sharon's photograph within days of the murder and positively identified the woman they'd seen as Sharon. Is it possible they're all wrong? Sure, but not probable. Then, of course, there's Margaret O'Brien, the woman who saw Sharon and a man she identified as Ken arguing on Auto Center Road around 9:30 p.m. If Jason's statement is true, well, Sharon would have been dead by that time. Finally, there are the witnesses, the husband and wife, who were actually at the scene of the murder on that very night. Remember the couple that picked up their son from Chuck E. Cheese's and drove there to check in on the property they were building? The only thing they saw at the construction site was one lone car parked there. The couple both placed themselves at the crime scene at 8:30 p.m., which is when Jason says Tony came back to the Meineke with Sharon's car. In other words, again, if Jason is telling the truth, that couple would have stumbled across a murder scene. But if any one of those many witnesses is right, none of what Jason is saying is remotely possible. So this was the end of the first day of interrogation. As soon as Jason's mother, Karen Carroll, picked him up that night, he was frantic and told her he didn't know what to do, that he just gave the police what they told him to.
According to John Carroll, Jason's dad, the next morning, Karen and Jason went out to run errands, and while they were gone, Sergeant Lammy called the house and spoke with him. Lammy asked John if Jason had said anything more about the case to them, and John responded that he hadn't. Lammy then told John that he and Karen had their work cut out for them, and that they had to help secure a confession out of Jason because Ken Johnson was the target of the investigation, and Jason could get immunity if he testified against Ken. When Karen and Jason returned home, John told them what Lammy said, and the three of them had a discussion that evolved into a shouting match at one point because Jason wouldn't budge. He kept insisting that he had nothing to do with the murder. John wrote in his notes that he yelled at Jason and told him, quote, "You stupid son of a bitch, these people are trying to help you." Finally, they decided to call the police and tell them that Jason wanted to recant his statement. Captain Morenci arrived at the house, and then Sergeant Lammy called them and told Jason to come back down to the station to talk, and Jason did. If you'll recall from last week, that recantation was never captured in either the transcript or the recording, but at trial, Sergeant Neil Scott said that Jason did recant, and in fact continued to recant his statement until Sergeant Lammy brought his mother into the interrogation room. And then, according to Scott, after Karen came into the room, Jason recanted his recantation. Now again, in order to evaluate the veracity of the confession he gave on this day, we want to look at the following factors: the length of the interrogation, the intensity of it, manipulation factors that can induce anxiety, and the role of any family members who were there. The 5-page handwritten confession Jason gave this day was signed at 6:25 p.m., which means Jason had been interrogated for nearly 6 hours before he gave it. We heard some of the audio of the interrogation last week, in which you should have been able to hear how intense the interrogation was. The short 30-minute recording we have contains a few moments of Jason being yelled at by Lammy and his mother, as we heard last week. But many more moments weren't captured in those 30 minutes. And while the transcript covers a bit more of the interrogation than the tape does, remember, a transcript doesn't include information like whether anyone is yelling or sobbing. At trial, however, Sergeant Lammy admitted that Jason was breathing hard, crying, and scared, saying that he wanted to go home. But Lammy didn't take the pleas to go home seriously. Sergeant Neil Scott testified that there were points that Jason was on his knees, his arms wrapped around his mother's legs, crying uncontrollably. This might have been the point in the transcript where Sergeant Lammy tells Jason, "Relax, kid, you're gonna crack up. I'm gonna open windows and let some air in. Relax." Jason responds that he can't relax and he wants to go home. He repeats 5 times that he wants to go home and then says, "I did this to my mom. Oh my God. I love you so much and I love Daddy so much. I wouldn't hurt you for anything in the world. I really can't believe this." Towards the end of the transcript, Jason says, "Oh, oh, 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 oh," repeatedly, as if he's in distress, as if he's sobbing. Having his mother in the room hasn't brought him any comfort because that was never her role, and that was an issue that was heavily litigated later. So then what exactly was Karen Carroll's role in the room?
At trial, Sergeants Lammy and Scott both testified she was only there as Jason's mother, that he had in fact asked for her. Maybe Jason had. We don't know because we have no record at all of what Jason said before his mother came into the room. But you might recall that according to Karen, Sergeant Lammy came to get her because Jason was being a little bastard, and they needed Karen's help to secure the confession. We also know that Sergeants Lammy and Scott weren't telling the truth when they testified that they told Jason that Karen was only there as his mother. Because at one point in the interrogation, Sergeant Lammy says, "Your mother is here in a dual role as a mother and professional. She is also a witness to what is going on in here."
"Your mother is here in a dual role as a professional. She's also a witness to what's going on here."
It doesn't make sense to her, and it doesn't make sense to us.
"It doesn't make sense to her, and it doesn't make sense to us."
Do you understand that you have to want to be truthful?
"Do you understand that you have to want to be truthful?"
At trial, Karen testified that Sergeant Lammy told her that Jason was the link to arresting Ken, and that she was told to jump in to question him when he wasn't cooperating. She wasn't brought into the room to support Jason, Karen testified. She was brought in to break him, and she did. She hammered away at him, calling him a liar, ordering him to waive his Miranda rights, and screaming at him until he gave a new written confession.
"The jury is listening to you. You sound like a criminal, not a guy that made a terrible mistake.
Sergeant, it's not that easy. I hope you do understand that."
"I understand it, but I don't know what you're going to do.
It's not going to be just like this for me to spit it out. I can't. I want you so much."
"Then do it. I can't. Why can't you? What are you
doing? I'm scared. I'm fucking scared.
Of course you're freaking scared. These guys are going to help you. We're not going to sit and jump on your ass and shoot you down."
"I feel like I'm going to jump on my ass and start down now."
"Who wants the truth out of you? Nobody is going to be able to help you anymore until you come forth with all the information that they need. Do you think I'm going to love you any less?"
"I don't know.
You might not.
I don't know.
And I'm going to stand by you through this. You are the link that saves me to put Justin and Pop behind friggin' time. If you put a knife, if you put a knife in that woman, I want to know. You stabbed her, didn't you?"
"Yes, I did.
How many times did you stab her?"
"73 times.
All right."
This confession, however, came after a lot of yield and shift, a red flag noted by Professor Haley Cleary, in which the person being interrogated changes their statement under pressure. Some of the details of the confession remain the same as the one from the night before, but this one is much more expansive. And throughout the transcript, Jason is repeatedly prompted to change or fix his answers when they don't match up to whatever it is Sergeant Lammy is looking for. For example, where the transcript picks up, Jason says Tony offered him $500 to play Bob. A few pages down, Sergeant Lammy challenges Jason about whether this was the actual amount that he was paid, and Jason changes it to $2,000. What did he spend his money on? Lammy asks, and adds, tell us something believable. Jason responds that he spent it on marijuana. Later on in the interrogation, in a part that's not in the tape we have, Jason's mother presses him on why he took part in the crime. Jason says it's because if he didn't do it, he wouldn't get paid. Karen isn't satisfied, though. She tells him, come on, more, more, I want more. So Jason gives her more. He says he needed the money to get his truck fixed, that he wanted so much to be like the other kids and hated his job. Tony gave him the money a week later, he says. Jason had to be pressured and prompted and corrected on nearly every aspect of this story. When and where did they meet Sharon? Why did Sharon Johnson have to be killed? Who stabbed her? Where was she stabbed in her body? How many people were at the crime scene? What happened to the knife in her shirt? Who moved her car and when? Every one of these details changes and evolves during the interrogation. First, Jason says he was asked to play Bob as a joke. Then, he says he doesn't know why he was asked to play Bob. Finally, he says he was explicitly told he would be playing Bob and be paid for it to help murder Sharon Johnson. Sergeant Lammy asks why Jason felt Sharon had to be murdered, and Jason responds, I wasn't briefed on that. Now that's an odd choice of words. I wasn't briefed on that. No 19-year-old refers to a conversation with a friend, Tony in this case, as being briefed. But it might be the kind of language you'd use if you've been prepped and given information by someone to help you formulate a statement. It also contradicts the fact that Jason does, when prompted over and over, admit that Sharon's husband Ken wanted her dead because she had walked in on him raping his daughter. That's not all, though. Sharon had also somehow witnessed Ken murdering another person. You would think that another murder would really capture the attention of the interrogators, but they kind of move right along, guiding Jason back to the night that Sharon was killed, and apparently never circling back to this detail.
Eventually, the hours of interrogation, with wildly changing details, led to two things. Karen accompanying the police to her house to retrieve a pocket knife she'd found recently in Jason's pants while doing the laundry, and another written confession. Here's what Jason writes.
On the night of July 27th, 1989, I was approached by Tony Puff, and he asked me if I would play a role of Bob for the sum of $2,000. I agreed to do so. He then told me she had to be murdered, Sharon Johnson. I had asked why. He then told me that she caught her husband raping his daughter, and that she caught him doing some other criminal things. Tony then asked me if I would meet him at Meineke Muffler on Elm Street, July 28th, between the hour of 6 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. July 28th, I was parked at Meineke Muffler at 6 p.m. Tony walked down to meet me. He arrived at about 6:15 p.m. 6:30 p.m., we then departed to the mall. We then arrived at the mall at about 7 p.m. Tony then stepped out of my truck and then started walking towards Sears and stood in front of the shopping center for about 10 minutes. Tony then started walking towards the parking lot to a green Subaru. He then starts to walk over towards my truck with a woman. She has sand brown hair and a white blouse with some kind of design on it. I introduced myself as Bob. Tony started talking to her saying, "Let's go to the place where you will be getting your money." Tony then instructed me to follow him in my truck, as he would be driving the Subaru. We then left the mall and headed down Route 101 to Wallace Road and then left on North Amherst. We then pulled about a quarter mile down the road to a pit. Tony pulled the car into the woods and I pulled my car off to the side. Tony and the woman stepped out of the car. I stepped out of my truck and we all walked down to the pit. Sharon started asking, "Why are we here?" And at that time, Ken Johnson stepped out of the woodline. Sharon then said, "What are you doing here?" Ken Johnson then said and called her a, quote, "cunt, that's not my baby. Who the fuck have you been cheating on me with? Who, goddammit, who?" Ken then looked at me and said, "Stab her or I'll kill you too." I then pulled a knife from my pocket. I then stabbed her in the back and in the chest a few times. Johnson then took the knife and proceeded to stab her in the chest maybe 4 or 5 times, and then Tony was handed the knife and he went apeshit on her. He threw the knife on the ground and Tony began to strangle her. I picked up the knife and put it back in my pocket. I then watched Tony take off her blouse and begin screwing around with her tits. He then began to take off her rings while he begins to choke her again, and Johnson is screaming, "Die, bitch, die." Tony then gets up and puts the blouse in his bag. Johnson then said something to Tony. Johnson then threatens me, "If you tell anyone, I will have you killed," picks up the pocketbook and walks down the road. Tony says, "Follow me to the mall." He picks up his bag and gets into the car. I followed him in my truck. We proceeded back down the way we came. We got to the mall and Tony parked the car back where Sharon had first parked it. Tony then stepped out of the mall, taking the keys and putting them into his pocket. From the mall parking lot, I proceeded back down Willow. Tony then asked me if I would drop him off at the Webster House on Webster Street, where he could be picked up for work, and then he took his bag with the blouse with him. Later on that night, when Tony got out of work, he found me downtown at Meineke. He then said that the car had to be moved to the other side of the mall. We arrived at the mall. Tony then got into the car and proceeded to the back parking lot of Sears. I followed in my truck. Tony parked the car, got out, locked the doors, and put the keys back into his pocket. He asked if I would take him home to the house where he was staying. I did this. I dropped Tony off. I went home. July 30th. I was parked at Meineke at about 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. Tony shows up with $2,000 cash and hands it to me. He also said if I tell anyone, I would wind up like her. He left. The money I got from Tony was in $20 and $50 bills. I spent the money on clothes, on a stereo system for my truck, and spent money on food, dates, cigarettes, and gas. I saw Tony at Meineke Muffler a few days later when he was getting the shit kicked out of him. From that point on, after that night, I heard he was going to North Carolina. November 25th, 1989, 6:20 p.m. Jason Carroll.
This confession, like the prior written one, is replete with details that just couldn't have happened. Details that the investigators had to have noticed. After all, at trial, even Sergeant Neil Scott testified that Jason's statement from this day was, quote, in the area of the facts. He's wrong, though. This statement can't even be in the area of the facts. Again, Jason states they met Sharon around 7 p.m. We know she couldn't have arrived from the mall yet because she's still buying lottery tickets at this time. He says after killing Sharon, he followed Tony back to the mall and parked Sharon's car wherever it had previously been. And then later that night, after Tony got off work, he found Jason downtown at the Meineke and they moved the car again to where it was eventually found. Tony, however, was working in Boston that night. His job didn't finish up until 2:30 a.m., and he started the next cleaning job not long after that. In fact, Tony was with his cleaning crew all night. And the detectives knew this. They knew what Jason was saying wasn't possible. The $1,500 that Jason says he spent on a stereo for his truck, well, that was factually inaccurate too. Jason had leased the truck from a man named Michael Janis, and after making a few monthly payments, Jason had stopped paying, so Janis took the truck back. Janis testified at trial that the truck came back looking as beat up as ever, and still had the exact same stereo system in it as it had before the lease. Jason hadn't replaced the stereo system at all. Beyond the provably incorrect details in the statement, there are details that simply make no rational sense. For example, why would Ken pay anyone to murder Sharon if he was going to be there to do it himself? Why would Jason show up with a knife and initiate the attack if he was only told to act like Bob to lure her to the crime scene? Lamb even picks up on this and asks Jason during the interrogation, "You see the thing that doesn't make sense, and I know you're still lying, that if you didn't know she was going to be killed, you just told us on tape that you're the first one that stabbed her." Lammy's right, it doesn't make sense. Neither does the idea that Sharon would believe that the scrawny teenager in a beat-up truck was Bob, the real estate agent, that owed her husband thousands of dollars. Or why Tony, whom Sharon knew well, would have had any connection to Bob. There are also some significant differences in this statement and the prior one. In the statement from the night before, Jason says that Ken Johnson was at the construction site with another man when they arrived there. This fourth man disappears during the interrogation, a fact that frustrates Sergeant Lammy, who asked him, "What about the fourth man?" To which Jason responds, "There was no fourth man." If the police were hoping to get more veracity from Jason's statements in the days following, it didn't get better. The next day, November 26th, was when Karen took her son to the state police headquarters, and Jason was asked to draw a diagram of the crime scene. His first attempt was scrapped, and Lammy reported that he gave him some direction. Jason tried again. In fact, he tried three more times. Yet, none of these drawings accurately reflected the crime scene, to the extent that they didn't even include the pond that Sharon's body was found next to. After that short meeting, in which Jason failed to accurately draw the crime scene, his mother drove him home and explained the immunity offer that Sergeant Lammy had made, apparently as a way of urging him to continue to cooperate. The following day, Monday, November 27th, was the day that Tony Puff was flown in from North Carolina. But hours before he arrived in Manchester, Jason Carroll was already in the police station. He had arrived around 12:30 p.m. and was ready to give yet another statement.
This is Sergeant Neil Scott of New Hampshire State Police speaking. The date is November 27, 1989. The time is approximately 1300 hours. The following record is being made at Bedford PD in the presence of Captain Leo Morenci of Bedford PD, Corporal David Eastman of New Hampshire State Police, and myself, Sergeant Neil Scott. The following statement is being recorded with the permission and acknowledgement of Jason Carroll. Jason, do you understand that this is being recorded?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
As you can tell, the sound quality in this tape is excellent, very much unlike the quality of the recording from the day that Karen Carroll was in the interrogation room. If you caught last week's addendum episode, our host Kevin Flynn offered a theory as to why. It was because the earlier recording was taken from a distance, and probably without permission. The tape recorder was likely in some corner and kept there so neither Jason nor Karen knew that they were being recorded. After all, the police didn't know which way Jason would land. But on this day, they knew exactly what he was going to say. Jason was ready to confess on tape.
When were you first contacted?
July 27th, 1988.
To do what?
Kill Sharon Johnson.
By whom?
Tony Puff.
What was discussed?
The amount of money I would be getting paid for, the place where, and how it would be done.
In this new version of the event, Jason doesn't say that he was asked to play Bob as a joke. He says he was hired, straight up, to kill Sharon, and that he was offered not $2,000 as he had said previously, but $5,000.
The place was the pit out here in Bedford. Amount was the sum of $5,000, and she was to be stabbed and choked.
Some of the previous details remain the same, such as why Sharon's husband wanted her dead and what time they went to the mall.
Did he give you any explanation as to why she was to be killed?
He had told me that Johnson, she had caught Johnson raping his daughter and doing some other very, or I've heard about some very other criminal acts.
What was the plan from when you left Tony Puff?
To meet him the next night, July 28th, 1980, at Monica Mofa between 6 and 6:30 p.m.
Did you tell anybody that you were going to meet him there?
No, I did not.
Did you in fact meet him that night?
Yes, I did.
What happened when you met him?
When I had met him that night, he had said, let's go to the mall. We went down South Willow Street, and we had parked at the mall.
Why the mall?
I guess that's where he was going to meet her. I guess he had set up something with her to meet there.
So you went to the mall?
Yes, we did.
Jason repeated what he had said previously, that they met Sharon in the parking lot, and he introduced himself as Bob. When he was asked why he did that, Jason said he had no idea. Maybe to protect himself, he responded, which is kind of a strange response. But anyway, there are lots of things about his story that have changed, like how they got Sharon to the construction site. In this version, Jason does not drive his truck and follow Tony and Sharon there.
I had walked over, and I introduced myself as Bob. And from there, I had already locked up my truck, had my keys on my person, and we had forced her into the car.
What? Explain that, please.
Why? I guess he was nervous about getting into the car or to getting her to the location for her death.
What happened next?
Tony, he was getting jittery. And he had forced her into the car and he told me to jump in.
How did he force her into the car?
He had shoved her in the car.
Which side of the car?
Left side of the car.
She drove.
Yes, she did drive.
Whose car did she drive?
Her car, in Subaru.
She drove the car?
She had drove the car.
Where did you sit?
I sat in the back seat.
Where did Tony sit?
Front seat.
And she drove the car?
She had driven the car.
Okay.
Did she protest getting in the vehicle?
She was nervous.
Did she protest getting in the vehicle?
Struggling, yes, she did.
Did Tony or you have to muckle onto her to put her in the car?
Tony muckled onto her and I grabbed her.
What did you say to her?
Tony was yelling, get into the car, and I just helped him get her into the car.
The officers asked Jason if the car was a four-door, and he says no, and that he had to go through the passenger side to get into the back. Except that he's wrong. Ken's car was two-door, but Sharon's car was four-door. He would have had no reason to get in from behind the passenger seat. Next, Jason says that Tony instructed Sharon on which direction to drive until they got to the construction site. Sharon drove at Tony's command, even though no one had any weapons out, said Jason.
Who was given directions?
Tony was giving her directions.
And she's driving all this time?
And she is driving.
She crying?
She was upset. She was crying a little.
Is anybody bearing any weapons at this time while you were in the car?
I had my knife with me.
Did she see it? Was it in your hand?
I had it in my pocket.
Did Tony have any weapons out?
No, he did not.
What kind of knife did you have?
I had a little pocket knife. It was brown. And a two-bladed knife.
Folding knife?
Folding knife. No lock.
Jason just described the pocket knife he often carried. A two-blade folding Barlow knife that didn't lock. This, he goes on to admit, is the murder weapon.
He had taken her out to the pit a little bit further, and I was right behind him. I did grab onto her arm to take her out there more.
Was she walking voluntarily, or was she struggling?
She was struggling. And I had reached for my knife.
Where was your knife?
In my back pocket.
Left or right back pocket?
My right back pocket.
And?
I had unfolded it. I had let go of my right hand on her left arm. I had replaced it with my left hand on her left arm. I had reached around in my back pocket with that knife. I had unfolded it with one hand. And from there, I stabbed her in the back.
Who else was present when you stabbed her in the back?
Tony Puff was present, and Kenneth Johnson was present.
How do you know Ken Johnson was there? How do you know that person was Ken Johnson?
From what you guys are telling me, he had a black beard.
It looks like Ken's black beard is back again, and Sergeant Scott recognizes what Jason said is a problem. He asked Jason, what other way did he know that it was Ken, and where did he come from?
Well, long before us, how did you know it was Ken Johnson?
I did not know it was Ken Johnson.
So you're saying when you were there, you did not know who this other person was?
Exactly.
Where did he come from? He didn't come with you.
No, he did not come from. He did not come with me.
Where did he come from?
He was around the area already. I don't know. I imagine he had come out of the woods.
Did you see him come out of the woods?
No, I did not see him come out of the woods.
Weren't you a little concerned that you were about to kill somebody and there's a stranger standing there?
Yes, I was, but Tony told me, do not worry.
What did Sharon Johnson do when she saw this man standing there?
She started screaming, what the fuck is going on? What the hell is going on? Why? What the fuck?
Did that man have an explanation? What did he say to her?
He just looked at her, laughed, said, you're going to die, bitch.
Jason then goes on in detail to explain how the three men present assaulted Sharon.
After he said, die, bitch, I had taken my knife and I had stabbed her in the back. She had started to fall to the ground and I had stabbed her a couple more times in the chest. From that point, Tony took the knife and he went apeshit on the woman. He had taken off her shirt, he ripped off her shirt, and he had taken it with him.
Had she already been stabbed when her shirt came off?
Yes.
Why did he take her shirt off?
I have no reason. I have no idea why he took her shirt off.
Where is she when the shirt was taken off?
Laying on the ground.
Is she dead or alive?
I don't know.
Where were you when the shirt was taken off?
Standing right next to her.
Did you watch him take the shirt off?
Yes, I did.
What happened after he took the shirt off?
He started playing with her tits and fucking around with her rings, choking her one hand, and then repeatedly he would go back with two hands, and then he proceeded to take off the rings.
Was she saying anything or moving at this time?
No, she was not.
How many times did you stab her?
Three times.
Where did you stab her?
Once in the back and twice in the chest.
How many times did Tony stab her?
I don't know the number.
Ken Johnson ever stab her?
No, he did not.
Did Ken Johnson ever touch her?
Yes, he did.
What did he do?
He choked her, too.
He choked her?
He had choked her, too.
At what point did Ken, this person you believe to be Ken Johnson, at what point did he touch her?
As Tony was choking her, Ken Johnson came down and he was choking her.
So at one time, both those individuals had their hands around her neck? Is that how they choked her?
Not at one time. Tony first then choked her, and then Johnson then choked her, and then Tony went back to choking her, taking off her rings, periodically slipping them off onto the ground.
According to Jason, Ken then walked off down one of the roads to where he must have had a car stash because Jason had not seen another car there. This caught the attention of Sergeant Scott because Jason made it sound like there was more than one road leading into the place that Sharon was murdered, and of course there wasn't, so that had to be clarified.
When you drove into that area with her in the car, as you drive down that dirt road towards the pond, is that the way you went?
I don't really remember, Corporal, how we got into it. I know a couple of roads we went down.
All right, but would you agree with me that there is one access road into where her body was found? At that time, there was one road that left the main road and veered off down towards the pond. Did you see more than one access road into the area where you left the body?
No, I did not.
Okay, so if I told you there was one road that led into where the body was found, where the body was, where you left the body, by the pond, is that correct? You left it by the pond?
Yes, I did. It was near a pond.
In case you missed that, the interrogator just told Jason that there was one road that led to the pond, and then asked him if he agreed that there was just one road. This is also the portion where the investigators repeat a few times that her body was found next to a pond, perhaps because Jason had not included a pond in any of his diagrams the day before. Jason also got something else pretty important completely wrong in this interrogation as it related to Sharon's bra. To refresh your memory, when Sharon's body was found, the bra was still on, but it was open in the front. According to Jason, the bra had been unsnapped from the back by Tony Johnson. He stated that Tony reached around behind Sharon as she was on the ground after she had been stabbed to undo the bra in order to molest her. There are a few things wrong here. First, Sharon's bra was front clasping, not back clasping. Next, her bra had not been unclasped at all. It had been cut open in the front and seemingly done so before she was stabbed, not after, because there were no cuts through the bra. Finally, and this is not so much a factual inaccuracy, but more a logical question, what attacker, in the heat of that moment, as he's stabbing a woman, wouldn't just push the bra up instead of reaching around to unclasp it from the back? It wasn't as if the bra had been removed at all that it needed to be unclasped. Now, the detectives don't try to correct Jason, but instead they start digging down into what happened to Sharon's shirt, which was never recovered.
After the shirt was taken off, Johnson, I assume it was Johnson, the man with the beard, had walked off their pocketbook. He had threatened me if I was to tell anybody that I would be killed myself. I was threatened. He had walked off. Tony had looked at me after he got fiddle-fucking with her tits, after he had picked up her shirt, and he said, let's get the hell out of here before somebody comes. We took off, and we got into the car.
Who drove the car away from there?
Tony Puff drove the car away from there.
And whose car was it that you drove?
Sharon Johnson's car.
Where were the clothes when you drove that car away?
He had put them in the back seat.
Were they in a bag, or were they just loose?
He had put them in a bag.
Where did the bag come from?
I guess he had already provided a bag.
What type of bag?
It was a green, light bluish green bag.
With handles, or just a paper bag, like a, or a plastic
like a,
bag?
Like
or?
A gym bag.
The officers know this bag is a bit of a problem now, because the story has changed from driving Jason's truck to the crime scene, and now only Sharon's car is involved. Jason's answer didn't really clear it up, but he went on. He said that he and Tony drove back to the mall and parked Sharon's car where it had been found next to Sears, an odd detail that only made sense for Carr hadn't been absent from the lot the next day. Jason then goes on to say that Tony took the bag with the clothes and the keys to the car, and then Jason dropped Tony off in Manchester so he could go to work. This is the first confession in which the time of the entire night is sort of possible.
Let me ask you about times. What time did you arrive in the sand pit that night?
Between 7:30 and 8 o'clock.
How do you know?
Guess, because we had met her at the mall a little after 7 o'clock.
How do you know that it was a little after 7 when you met her?
I looked at the watch on my the watch in my truck.
How long did you ride around between the mall and in the sand pit?
No, we didn't.
You went directly to the pit?
We went directly to the pit.
What was your travel time?
Twenty-five minutes. Maybe 30.
So that would put you in the sand pit at what time?
I would put us in the sand between 7:30 and 8 o'clock.
And what time approximately was she stabbed?
Between 7:45 and 8:10.
Why do you say that?
Because we had got back to the mall at 8:30.
The earliest that Sharon could have arrived at the mall after getting her lottery tickets was around 7:30 p.m. If she'd been immediately abducted by the boys and taken to the construction site, getting there around 8 p.m., it was possible the attack didn't take long and the boys made it back to the mall around 8:30 p.m. or shortly thereafter. Again, though, this wouldn't account for the couple who visited the site that night around 8:45 p.m., or the fact that Sharon was seen in the mall by multiple people between 7:30 and 8 p.m. Moving on, the police asked Jason about what happened to the knife, and he tells them he picked up the knife off the ground. It wasn't very bloody, so he wiped it off onto his own hand and then put it back in his pocket. He never got rid of the knife. He kept it for a number of little random things, and it eventually got put through the laundry after he forgot it in his jeans recently. Now here's where Jason says he next saw Tony, and this is why the morning of Saturday, July 30th is an important date in this case. It's the morning that the Johnsons' friends visit Ken to offer their condolences, and also the morning that Ken Johnson's house is under surveillance by the police.
When was the next time you saw Tony Puff after that night?
Saturday night. Saturday during the day.
Where did you see him?
I was downtown.
Where? Downtown where? What town?
Manchester.
Where did you see him?
I had seen him around the Monkey Muffler area near Supreme Roast Beef on Elm Street.
How did you, were you supposed to meet him or did you just bump into him?
I had just bumped into him.
What transpired when you bumped into him?
He had asked me if I'd take him a ride to Bow.
What ride to Bow?
So he could pick up some money.
He wanted you to take him to Bow?
He wanted me to take him to Bow.
What time Saturday did you meet him?
I had seen him about 10:30.
Saturday morning?
Saturday morning.
Just by
coincidence?
Coincidence, you ran into him.
I ran into him.
Did you, in fact, take him to Bow?
Yes, I did take him to Bow.
Where? Where in Bow did you take him?
To a man's house by the name, I assume again, it was Johnson.
Can you describe the house?
No, I can't.
What color it was?
Do you know where it was in Bo, how you got to it?
I don't know how I got to it. Tony had given me directions to the house.
So you went to a house in Bo?
A house in Bo.
You can't describe that house?
No, I cannot describe that house.
Nothing about it? The driveway, the house, the shutters, the color, the roof?
No, I didn't.
How did you get into this house? Did you go into the house?
No, I did not go into that house.
What did you do?
I stayed in my truck.
There are a lot of problems with this story, including the fact that Jason can't describe anything about the house or how it was structured. But the biggest problem is this, that Jason has forgotten he was supposed to work in the part of them moving the car again that night, which means this trip to see Ken could not have been the next time he saw Tony after the murder.
Let me back up just a minute. On the night after the murder and you went to Meineke Muffler, you sat there?
The night of the murder.
The night of the murder.
I had sat there.
For how long did you sit there?
5 to 6 hours. Maybe more.
And where did you go? At some point you left Meineke Muffler. Where did you go?
Yes. Tony, I don't know how he got back downtown. From there he had met me. It was not set up to be met there. But he said we had to move the car into the back parking lot.
Okay, so at some point after you leave Tony in the mall parking lot, you and Tony leave. You take Tony to the
mall, to
Webster Street.
Wait, you get me confused.
After you brought the car back to the mall, after you had killed Sharon Johnson.
Yes.
Where did you take Tony?
To Webster Street, to the Webster house.
And you went to Meineke Muffler?
Yes, I did.
And you sat there for 5 or 6 hours?
I must have.
At some point, did you run into Tony again that evening?
Yes, I did, later on that night, which was I was just saying.
What time did you run into him again?
It was early in the morning. I don't know what time it was.
This is early Friday morning?
This is early Friday morning.
How early?
It wasn't even light out yet.
Where did you meet him?
He met me down at Meineke Muffler.
And what was discussed when you met him?
He had told me that we had to move the car. I had asked why. He just said, he had told me that's not the place where it should be. And I just didn't ask any more questions.
Now they were able to account for Sharon's car not being what was eventually found when the lot was searched in the day after the murder. Moving forward to Saturday again, Jason says that Tony returned from inside the Johnson house to the truck after 5 minutes with an envelope full of cash. He pulled out a wad of $5,000 in 20s and 50s and gave it to Jason. Around this point in the interrogation, the tape ends and has to be flipped over. During the time the tape was off, Jason had been shown a lineup.
The tape is now turned over. A portion of the interview was not recorded because the tape ran out and I did not see it. During the portion that was not recorded, Jason has been shown two folders with eight photographs of eight white males in same, all numbered. And Jason has been asked to look at that photographic lineup and tell me if he can recognize anyone in that lineup. Of the eight people in that lineup, Jason has recognized and pointed out the male subject in number five. And would you tell me again, Jason, why you focus your attention on the individual in number five?
Because I remember the black beard.
Is there anything else about the individual number five that any facial features, any expressions, anything in that number five other than the black beard that draws you to that one?
He was also heavy set. These other men are really heavy set.
Do you specifically know who the individual is in number five?
No, I don't specifically know who he is. Now I would know what his name would be.
You know now what his name is?
What his name is, after all this has gone down, yes. It would be Ken Johnson.
It seems like Jason has made a positive identification of the man who met them at the construction site the night that Sharon Johnson was murdered. The problem being that the man that Jason picked out from the lineup wasn't Ken Johnson at all. First of all, Ken was never heavy set. If anything, he was tall and lanky. Next, Jason again mentions the black beard, which he had earlier said he knew about because the police had told him about it. So why did the police tell Jason that Ken had a black beard? Maybe because shortly after the murder, a mall employee had reported to the police she had seen a pregnant woman at the mall around 7:30 p.m. holding hands with a bearded man. The man's hair was dark and his beard was big and bushy. The police were wrong about the beard, though. They just didn't know it at the time they fed Jason the details. Sergeant Lammy testified that it wasn't until after Jason had given these statements that the police got footage showing Ken Johnson at a bank drive-thru window the night before the murder. In the footage, Ken is clearly clean-shaven except for his mustache, and he certainly couldn't have grown a big bushy beard overnight. Much of Jason's confession contains details that are factually inaccurate, and at many other points, he simply doesn't have the answers to the questions he's being asked, despite being harangued.
We asked you before, was there a weapon used on her that night to keep her in line?
No, there was not.
Are you absolutely positive?
I am positive.
There was no knife or a gun or something kept on her to keep her in the car?
No, there was not.
At some point in time, Puff had the keys to the car?
He had keys, yes, he did.
Do you ever remember hearing him say that he gave somebody some of those keys or gave all the keys to somebody?
No.
Did you ever ask him what happened to the keys?
No, I have not.
What happened eventually to those keys?
What happened eventually, I do not know, Captain Morency. The night when he had gone back to move the car, he had had the keys with him. And we had moved the car, when we had left, he had the keys with him.
You have no idea what happened to those keys?
I have no idea what happened to those keys. I have no idea what happened to the pocketbook. And I have no idea what happened to that goddamn shirt.
The interview was terminated at exactly 1400 hours.
It wasn't long after Jason's recorded confession that he confronted Tony Puff at the crime scene, which amounted to nothing because Tony said he didn't know Jason. And then Tony was brought into the station. After Tony was questioned for 90 minutes, Tony's aunt and uncle arrived and talked him into cooperating. And by 7 p.m., he was ready to give his own recorded confession. Tony's story went something like this. That a week before the murder, he had called the Johnson house looking for Lisa, and Ken told him he wanted to talk to him. When Tony went over to talk to Ken, Ken told him he wanted his wife dead and was willing to pay $10,000 for it.
Anyway, he told me he'd pay me to do it, to kill her.
Okay, it was an amount discussed.
$10,000.
Okay, go ahead.
And I thought about it, and I asked him how we were going to do it. And he said, well, I'm giving you $10,000 to figure out how to do it. Mm-hmm. He says, I don't want to be any part of this, but he wants me to do it. And if anybody else, you know, anybody I knew I could trust,
mm-hmm.
that would do it with me. And I said I'd think about it. I thought about it. And I got back in touch with him. And then I got up with Jason and I confronted him about it. And he went willingly.
Tony went on to state that he asked Jason to play a man named Bob. Lammy asked him where he came up with that idea. Had Ken suggested it? No, said Tony. Playing Bob was his idea, and he was the one to share the idea with Ken. Which, of course, makes no sense, because Sharon had been telling others about this guy named Bob weeks before she was killed. Tony's statement continues to go off the rails.
We met her in the mall, and we asked her to go outside, come outside with us.
Where in the mall? Approximately where?
In the middle of the mall by the food court somewhere around there. I don't remember nothing. I don't know.
Okay.
Listen, why don't we do this? I'll just keep making notes, and we'll go through the questions after, okay? Why don't you keep on telling the story the way it is? How's it? That'll be easier for you. Okay? Okay, why don't you look right into the mic?
It's hard for me to talk.
I know. I understand.
Tony goes on to say that they asked Sharon to go for a ride with them, and Jason, Tony, and Sharon walked out together to her car. During the ride, he said there was yelling and talking and Sharon asking them why they took her. And when they got to the construction site...
Then when we got there, she struggled. Jason drove the knife in her back, stabbed her again, I choked her. She fell to the ground. And her shirt was pulled off, but I didn't pull it off. I don't know how I got pulled off, but I didn't pull it off.
Okay. How many times did you stab her, truthfully? Truthfully now, Tony. It's a one-time shot to tell the truth. Because that's what you want to be doing. You don't have to have the exact number of times. I want to know how many times do you think you may have stabbed her.
A couple of times.
Then Sergeant Lammy asked Tony about the knife. Remember, Jason said the knife was his. A brown-handled folding pocket knife that he always kept with him.
Who did you get the weapon from?
The bleeped out part there is Tony saying, it was Lisa's knife. It looked like Lisa's knife anyways. For some strange reason, just like all references to Jason and Karen's relationship were bleeped out, Lisa's name is bleeped out of the entire conversation.
And who had the knife for, who gave it to, so you're not sure who gave that to Jason Carroll?
This, of course, is highly problematic.
Tony.
Yes.
Let me just tell you this. Jason has given us a knife that he has identified as the murder weapon. As I have told you before, this case did not produce much physical evidence. On tape, in front of this jury, a jury that you want to believe that you are willingly and want to tell the truth, do you know where that shirt went to? I don't care if you took it and it was destroyed. I don't care if you took it and have it in North Carolina. I don't care if you took it and gave it to someone. That shirt, believe it or not, is extremely important and valuable to this investigation. In the name of Sharon Johnson, in her memory and her spirit, I'm asking you to tell me where that shirt is. Please. Because I think you still have it.
Sergeant Lammy here signals to Tony that his knife story is, well, unnecessary because they already have the murder weapon accounted for. But then he moves on. A little later, though, Lammy, who doesn't believe Sharon would have just happily jumped into a car and left the mall without threat of force, tries again.
Do you recall who drove that car? You've got Sharon in the car, and you and Jason will leave the mall and go to the pit. Who's driving that car? If you don't remember...
I did.
Sorry, what was that?
I did.
You drove the car?
Yes.
If we told you that Jason thinks he remembers that Sharon drove the car, what would you say about that?
From the pit? What? Wait a minute.
From the mall.
She drove the car, I drove the car back.
She drove the car to the pit?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Who were you holding on her forcibly? I want to hear from you to make her do these things. Why would she keep on driving unless she was terrified? Truthfully, don't Tony say it.
The knife.
that same knife or another? Truthfully, Tony.
Another knife.
Where is that knife?
I don't know.
Whose knife was it? What did it look like?
Man, I don't know. I've had so many knives. I've had so many things.
Was it a knife of yours?
No, it wasn't mine.
Whose was it?
I gotta plead the fifth on that one.
This response was as puzzling to Sergeant Lammy as it probably is to you, but after that, no knife is ever mentioned again.
Beyond where they met Sharon and where the murder weapon came from, Tony's confession doesn't match Jason's at nearly every turn. Tony says he drove the car back to the mall and parked it that night, then went to work, then returned to the car later that night to move it alone, all by himself, to where it was eventually found. First, Jason doesn't appear in this part of the story, and second, if he had moved the car the same night, it would have been found on Friday when the lot was repeatedly checked. But it wasn't found there until Saturday morning. He also says that after initially parking the car back at the mall, he and Jason went to Ken Johnson's house. But first, it takes a little gentle reminding by Sergeant Lammy about what car is where.
What happens now?
We're getting our vehicles and leave.
Okay, what vehicles are we talking about now? Because you said Johnson came out of nowhere, so what was his vehicle?
I don't know.
How many vehicles are there now?
Well, obviously it had to be us. I mean, our car, the one we took down there.
Okay, what car did you take down there?
Her car.
Okay. And that's the only vehicle taken down there, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, where was Jason's truck left at? Do you remember? Well, if you went to the mall...
It's at the mall.
Okay. So go ahead. Now what happens? What happens? You get in the car.
I shut the car. Get in the car. We go there, back to the mall. We put the car back behind the mall by the food court in Sears.
Right.
Get out of the car. I put the keys in my pocket.
Right. Okay.
Then we drive.
In what?
Jason's truck.
Okay. And where do you go? Didn't you say you went to Johnson's house a few minutes ago?
Yes.
Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, well, explain what happened. Why did you go? Was that planned? Why did you go there?
Get some money. Get the money.
That night? On Thursday night?
It's Friday, I think.
No, it's a Thursday.
Oh, yeah, Thursday night.
All right, now... Tell me who you saw at Johnson's, how you got there, where you parked the vehicle, and what happened. That's very important. Just what you can remember. It is now 7:40 p.m. We're continuing with this statement. Just tell us what you can remember for now. We'll go through, you know, and help you remember after. But for now, let us get on tape what it is you do remember, okay?
We drove up in the yard, I went in, I got an envelope, I came back out, I gave him half it, gave half the money to Jason, mm-hmm. Me and Jason left.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then we went our separate ways after that. Thank you.
Tony is never asked about the timeline of the night of the murder. Not when he met Sharon or what time he went back to move the car. But if we rely on Jason's story to figure that out, that would mean if they had returned to the Johnson house that night to get paid, they would have gotten there around 9 p.m. The problem is that while the two girls, Melanie and Julie, arrived home around that time, Ken didn't return until at least an hour later. And Jason and Tony couldn't have been at the house at 10 p.m. because that was the exact time that Tony was picked up by his boss to go to work. So what can we make of the veracity of Tony's confession? Tony's interrogation tape is full of the same kinds of long silences and hesitancy you heard in the last clip. He also confuses the days everything happened in numerous places in the tape and has to be corrected every time. Tony's story deviates from Jason's on nearly every detail of the story, other than them just both being paid to kill Sharon and then carrying the murder out. Now you might be thinking, well, it's close enough. But remember, a few hours earlier, the detectives made Jason confront Tony at the murder scene and literally recite his own confession to him. So even before Tony's brought into the station, the seeds of the story have been planted. Tony just can't remember the details. If we pull back from all the details of Tony's confession that were either completely different than Jason's or simply couldn't work because of the laws of time and physics, there's also the bigger picture. Would a kid like Tony go to work cleaning greasy commercial kitchens for 16 hours immediately after being handed $5,000 in cash, an amount he had probably never seen in his life? And would he kill the grandmother of his child? Neither of these things seemed likely to me, and I'm still in amazement that Jason and Tony's confession seemed plausible to the investigators. But they did. That same night, shortly after midnight, both Tony Puff and Jason Carroll were placed under arrest. And now, the investigators had enough evidence to get Ken too. Next time on Undisclosed. If you have any information related to this or any of the cases we cover, remember you can reach us on our phone line at 410-205-5563. Once again, that's 410-205-5563. As always, a big thank you to Baluki for our logo, to Patrick Cortez for our theme music, and of course to Mithil Thelhan for keeping the ship tight and the ball rolling as our executive producer. A special thanks to my research assistant Jennifer Leahy and her mom, and homicide investigator Sarah Kalin, who spent way too long in a car with me driving around New Hampshire.
Like she's gonna hit that pole.
Yeah. Lady drivers.
So, the knife, you know, if the knife is still in evidence and we can DNA test it, and they're like, surprise, there's absolutely no blood on the knife. Am I looking north or south?
Nope, north.
Okay. But here's the problem with that is that according to Jason's mother, the knife had been in one of Jason's pants or somebody's pants, and she put it through the wash. So the question is, if that knife had been run through the wash, does that mean it would have removed all traces? I wonder, though, I'm going to go back to her and ask, is that true that happened? Or is that something that Lammy said, maybe that's what suggested to you?
Right, but is that more of the false confession?
Right. And that's why you don't find anything. So I want to revisit that issue. But other than the knife, yeah. You know, they did fingerprinting. I don't know if they found any prints anywhere. Her car was printed. Her car was, a lot of stuff was taken, and they found no prints.
So it was claimed.
It was claimed. You know, DNA testing, like, it's insane, but it's almost like unless it hits on a known serial killer with no connection to Jason Carroll, which is like a guaranteed clam dunk, is still maybe not, what might not be enough to exonerate him. I mean, like, because of how states take a position on these issues, the best case scenario would be that we find all this great physical evidence and we do DNA testing and it hits on somebody in the system, you know, like an unknown offender.
Yeah.
But I have seen cases in which just, including Adnan's case,
yeah,
in which just because the defendant's DNA is not there, the state will not admit that doesn't mean that he didn't do it. They'll say just because it wasn't there doesn't mean he wasn't there. It just means his DNA is not there. I mean, it's shocking that that can happen, but it does it's happened in Adnan's case. They couldn't find any DNA connecting Adnan to the case, but they found one female allele. And so instead of trying to figure out who that was, they're like, well, we're done. You know, just because we didn't find his DNA doesn't mean he didn't kill her.
I mean, in a way, that's already happened in this case, right? Because they couldn't find any physical evidence linking him to the scene, right?
I mean, so the knife is a knife that he confessed to have used, and I guess that would be the only, like, real evidence, I guess, but...
There are problems with the knife.
I mean, there's many problems with the knife,